this is not just any other company. This is the corporate behemoth of the day, and cracking the shell, cracking the anti-union shell of Amazon. I really do think that it would, that the effects of that would resound outward. But to your question, I think that one thing that's interesting about the present moment is that there's a lot of interest in organizing, but there's also very high public approval ratings of unions. And I think that people understand that there's a essential dynamic at work in American society where there are these corporate overlords that are holding people down. They don't know what to do about it. They tend to concentrate too much energy on the Epstein files, not enough on just like corporate power in the abstract. But I do kind of think that there's energy for that at this particular moment. I think it's also relevant that Amazon, as opposed to a company like Walmart, has a more affluent customer base. And so Amazon is really focused on urban centers, whereas a company like Walmart, it's more supplying basic goods to suburban and rural customers. I think a strike at Walmart really does hit at that dynamic that you're describing, where people are like, hey, this is where I get my groceries. Like, I can't afford groceries like at this other store. And so if you go on strike, this is a problem for me in particular. At Amazon, it's a little bit different.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I'm Alex Hochuli in São Paulo, Brazil, joined by George Horror in London, co-host. Hello.
Correct. You are joined by me.
Excellent. And joined once again for, I don't know, is that the third appearance? Ben Fong?
That sounds right. Yeah. Hey, guys. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, delighted to have you back. Ben, if you're not familiar, is editor at Damage and keeps a Substack on labor and logistics at ontheseams.substack.com. I'm going to mention a couple of different things as we go along, and as usual, all the links will be found in the show notes. But specifically, to elaborate a little bit before I kind of pass over to Ben, we're talking about, well, about moving things about logistics, about the people who work in logistics and the power they at least tacitly have. And then we're also going to move on to speaking about a specific means of moving things and people, that is the train, an avatar of modernity, perhaps the avatar of modernity. Ben and George have written the editorial to the forthcoming print issue of Damage magazine on trains. And we're going to be talking about why trains and why we're talking about trains today in the kind of second part of this episode. That issue contains things like, just to give a shout out to this one, we'll probably do more episodes on trains and some of the themes of that arise from this issue on trains as the month and next 2 months kind of go on. But there's things like Ryan Zickraff on the 158-year story of the Steelton Mill's rise and eventual fall, and how he sees that as a grim object lesson in the fading strength of American industry. Paul Prescott on the history of organized labor activity in the railroad industry. We had the aforementioned editorial from Ben and George, which we're going to discuss today. There's me also on the history of Brazilian railways. I'm sure that has you salivating, listener. That'll be towards the end of this episode. Please do stick around despite my ironic comments about my own issue of interest. Anyway, we should get started properly. So on labor and logistics, people, Ben, who peruse your Substack, will be struck with many articles entitled something like A Primer on X Company's Distribution Network. So what are these articles, firstly? Who are they for? And more broadly, what are you trying to do with On the Seams?
Sure. Maybe I'll start with the last question because it helps contextualize why I do these deep dives, these brief primers on the distribution networks of these big companies. I had been reading supply chain and logistics textbooks with a friend of mine, Scott Jenkins, who I started the Substack with. He works for Teamsters for Democratic Union. And we had been thinking about a lot of things related to what we call like the logistical economy. I think that the more common understanding of today's economy is like a service economy or a deindustrialized economy. The idea being that after industrialization, There's deindustrialization and a move back to primarily service-focused economy. And that's not wrong, but if you look at the big corporations of the day, like the major employers in the United States, I think it's Walmart, Amazon, Target, Home Depot, and Kroger, all in that order. And they're all big retail outlets. They're all benefits. They're all beneficiaries of globalization. So it's not just that we stopped making stuff, it's that we started importing stuff from abroad. And that has resulted in just a wildly new kind of distribution system within the states. And so part of what I was interested in the Substack, Scott and I were just figuring out what these distribution networks looked like, how they've changed over time, what kind of power they give the retailers that control them, and you know, what it's doing to work as well in the warehousing and transportation sector. And the more we dug into it, the more we figured out that there's just not a ton of information out there for living in such a visible world. It's actually quite difficult to understand how these distribution networks operate for understandable reasons. The big retailers don't really advertise where their facilities are, what they do, how they get their product to stores, how they get their product to your doorstep. And so part of the project is just figuring out how it works, where the facilities are, what the facility differentiation looks like, what kind of automation is being deployed in these different facilities, how they're changing. And it's all kind of being driven by the case of Amazon, which is far and away the sort of automation leader in the warehousing sector. But every company is changing to meet the moment. I think that there's a real desire to figure out what digital retail looks like, even agentic retail in the new age of AI. And so as a result, all the retailers are changing stuff up, opening new kinds of facilities, experimenting with different distribution models. And so things are changing. I'm just trying to keep track of what's going on, really.
I mean, so, it's kind of cool. Ben will chuckle at this, I suspect, but it's quite fun, some of these primers, because there's lots of maps and infographics and things like that. So I think that's quite fun. I don't know if everybody's of the same opinion.
But why would you not find that fun? You've got an infographic, you've got a map.
Yeah.
Ben, I did want to just ask a bit of a follow-up, maybe two-part follow-up. The first part, are you a seamster? Because this is like a teamster and a scenester. You don't have to answer that. But what actually are the seams and why are they important?
Yeah. So one of the big inspirations for Scott and I was this guy named John Womack, who has been working on this longer book that's actually been published in Spanish, but not in English, about technical connections in different industries. He did this interview with the labor organizer Peter Olney called Labor Power and Strategy. It's a great book. I highly recommend it to everyone. It's just an interview that Peter and Glenn Parashek did with John Womack a few years back. And it's got some responses from labor leaders today. And Womack's basic argument is that labor power is situated. We tend to think of labor and capital as involved in this this grand battle for supremacy, and that this is the sort of central antagonism of any capitalist society between labor and capital. And that's true, but what Womack wants to say is that it's not just that you know the workers get together and express their associational power and overcome the boss. It's that they have to be smart about it, and they have to leverage the technical connections in their favor to do so. So one particular example that's close to my heart is in the CIO moment when the UAW was first forming and they were trying to organize General Motors, which at that point was the largest employer of the day, the kind of template organization of corporate capitalism. When they were organizing General Motors, they picked out strategic facilities. And so they had sat in on many different buildings in the Flint plant in December 1936, and then going into January 37. But the strike had sort of stalled out. They weren't sure what the governor was going to do. And then I would say the decisive moment in the strike really came when they figured out how to occupy the engine building, GM Plant 4, And once they did that, they sort of stopped the production of engines altogether, and GM just couldn't make cars.